Welcome to Life Quest Liberty, live in-depth conversations with today's top writers, editors, and spiritual leaders concerning religious freedom around the world. On today's broadcast, we'll examine local and international factors that may be impacting your right to worship and obey God as your conscience dictates. I'm your Life Quest Liberty host, Charles Mills. You've probably seen those signs along highways that are under repair. In big, bold letters, you're told that the construction is taking place as a result of your tax dollars at work. Today, we discuss not highway construction, but defense construction. Lincoln Steed, editor of Liberty Magazine, has a few thoughts on the subject. Lincoln, what's on your mind today?
Well, that's a good introduction, and it goes to the heart of what I want to share on religious liberty in the United States. But I do want to take it even wider than that and further back than where we live today. I want to give it a biblical basis. In the book of John, toward the end, somewhere around chapter 15 up to 17, in my Bible, there's a lot of red-letter paragraphs. And anybody that's read their Bible more than passingly knows that most Bibles, when they put things in red, that's the words of Jesus Christ. You know, this is a radio program, but you go on television and there's quite a few religious programs and people pontificate a lot about religion. They preach a lot. They even use the Bible on occasion. But it's amazing to me how seldom the preachers and the presenters go directly to the words of Jesus. Yes. You know, they'll discuss deep theological points that even I have trouble understanding. And it seems to me very often if they went to the direct words of Jesus, it's quite often very clear. And these verses that I'm referring to today in the end of John, I think are significant because they're at the end of Jesus' ministry. He'd spent 3.5 years with his followers, his disciples, but there were many more. There were at least 70, and then women and others who traveled with, you know, they were sort of a movable cavalcade of followers. And Jesus taught them as they traveled. And here are several chapters, all in red. Curiously, even as I was waiting for this program to begin, there's just one, well, on the double spread I'm looking at, there's really only one major verse that's not in red, and it's Judas saying something to Jesus, which is very telling. Yes. He says, "Lord, how is it that you will manifest yourself to us and not to the world?" Typical. Here's a guy that didn't understand what was going on, so he was revealing he didn't have the spiritual vision. But Jesus was explaining the ways of the world and the ways of his kingdom. And in chapter 15, the second half of the chapter, he talks about the reaction of the world to those who are following him. And there's a subhead that says the world's hatred, the coming rejection. And it goes on and on about what you can expect. There's going to be a conflict. They'll hate you. And in chapter 16, verse 2, he says this to Jews. Of course, he was speaking to fellow Jews at that point. Christianity hadn't really gone beyond the immediate Jewish nation. And he said, "They will put you out of the synagogues," the religious meeting houses. "Yes," he says, "the time is coming that whoever kills you will think that he offers God service." And that's a sobering comment.
It certainly is.
And living in the United States, I think that takes on a slightly different dimension because as the Jews of Jesus' time, we equate often our state, our civil society, with what it means to be a Christian or it means to be a moral and religious person. And they certainly did that in Jesus' time. And it was soon to come to pass, as he said, that they were rejected. Saul or Paul, as he became known, and other followers of his were stoned. They were harassed. And ultimately, some of them were killed.
Yes.
And I don't think it was done with deep personal malice. It was done with the sense that here we're getting rid of something that, or a person and their ideas that are dangerous to the public order. They'll tear down our religious life. They'll destroy our society. And we're merely saving all of society and our community from worse troubles by dealing even, what is that statement in the U.S. military? Extreme prejudice.
Extreme prejudice.
Extreme
yes.
prejudice. Remove them. And I've thought about that a lot, particularly as a Seventh-day Adventist. Our church has an emphasis on prophecy. We look in Revelation chapter 14, and it speaks there clearly at the very end of time, dealing with religious and civil powers that will compel to a certain form of behavior. And it says there'll be a death penalty if you don't go along with it. And I've always wondered, how could this be in any Western country, and particularly in the United States, with its wonderful tradition of freedom and civil liberties and openness to many things, including religious diversity? And thankfully, none of us know experientially quite how that will happen, because it has not yet happened. But I want to discuss an event today that I think gives a little window into perhaps how this could come about. We've been in a war on terror for a long time, yes. Or at least a war against terrorists, yes. For a long time. But since 9/11, 2001, specifically, it's been stated we're in a war on terror, which, as somebody pointed out recently, is the only, well, maybe not the only, but it's the most major war against an abstraction. You're like, how do you define terror?
Really?
You say that this person is a terrorist because you're afraid. And it very often is before they've done anything, maybe just an ideology or a viewpoint that you disagree with. And so you see them as potentially dangerous. And certainly with certain groups like Al-Qaeda, we know they're dangerous. They stand for deep hatred of the Western aims. But the latest thing that's come about, that we have an article coming up in Liberty Magazine, and I did not see this coming, but it startles me. Just a few days ago now, the U.S. Congress, or the Senate first, then the House of Representatives, passed into law a rather routine piece of legislation. It's the National Defense Authorization Act. Mm-hmm. And I read part of it. It's 682 pages. I think it's on a fairly liberal expose of the Bush era, Fahrenheit 9/11.
Yes.
By, what's his name, Moore.
Yes.
He interviews one of the congressmen and asks him about things that they'd approved, and he leans toward him and he says, my son, he says, none of us read all of this stuff. Maybe some aides do, but, you know, 682 pages, it's likely most of the hundreds of congressmen and senators have not themselves read through. And in this case, they should have, because among all the mundane things like pay standards within the military and disciplinary procedures and weapons systems, you know, all of the necessary things to keep the military system going, there were two fairly small items, a couple of sentences each, that had been written up in a quiet room somewhere up by themselves, not through any committee, by Senators Levin and McCain. They'd written two real provisions that really changed things, or at least attempt to change what many people have thought were legal protections, because it says there that in the war on terror, the battlefield is the entire world, mm-hmm. including the homeland. And remember, this is a military appropriations bill, so it's talking about the military. And then it says that in prosecuting this war on terror in the homeland, that the military can detain indefinitely without trial even citizens.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, that's an amazing thing. And
the founding fathers would be spinning in their graves right about now.
Absolutely. And this is where the debate heated up, because some people that want this provision don't see it as threatening what are foundational principles, because they're still written in law. They're in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence. You know, I know my U.S. history. It wasn't just tea or attempts at taxation that fired them up. It was their fear of arbitrary arrest without due process.
Exactly, exactly.
They were really hung up on due process, and with good cause, because after the War of Independence, the next major war that the U.S. Had, the War of 1812, was with England, who did not accept their independence. Mm-hmm. Most U.S. citizens forget that. It didn't really end with the British withdrawing after the Revolutionary War. It continued with the War of 1812, because in the interim, England refused to recognize that this was an independent country, and any time they encountered American sailors on a ship at sea anywhere in the world, they would impress them into the British Navy as British subjects, and they felt they had the right. I mean, even if you were a Briton, you were subject to abduction,
yes,
and impressment
right.
into the that's Navy, right. and then if you deserted, they would hunt you down and hang you. That was bad enough for the British, but here, Americans, they believe they're independent. Well, England didn't accept that. As I say, the whole issue was a huge one It was it informed the War of Independence, and it led to the second major war. So today, for us to give that away so readily in theory, in practice, we can hope, but I think the evidence is fairly strong that in practice, the average American has little immediately to fear from a change in the legal language. But who knows down the line, with the changing dynamic or a willingness to apply this grant that's been given, we could see, as Jonathan Turley yesterday, a law professor from George Washington University, was on C-SPAN for quite some time. I know him because he's just written an article for Liberty Magazine, but he's on national TV quite a bit. He's had Washington Post articles. He's a recognized authority on legal matters. And he said, I couldn't believe what he said. He said, I will expect to see in due course what we're seeing overseas, where the predator drones are liquidating citizens within the country who are a threat. Probably most people won't shed a tear because generally they seem to have picked on egregious cases. But very few people realize that legal precedents are set this way. And it is just absolutely contrary to the Constitution, to the Western principles of the autonomy of the individual that were established in Runnymede, where the Magna Carta was signed by an unwilling King John, who granted this relief from the previous power of the king to arrest anybody and put him in the dungeon forever, and that was the end of it. We've come a long way since then, but in some ways we're going back to it. And it may not affect the average person, but it's now given to the government, in this case the military, as the sword of the government. They actually, if it's been decided in some secret chamber or in the president's Oval Office that you or your neighbor or someone is a threat, you vanish, either killed or imprisoned. Now, like I say, many people, including Senator Lindsey Graham, got up and said, this is great stuff, you know. I mean, he didn't dodge the words. He says, yes, the military can detain citizens indefinitely. And many people think this is great. But they don't think of the ramifications to this, that a dissident religious group out of the mainstream, not dissident from the government, but seen by mainstream religionists as not being supportive enough of a civil agenda, not being, as has been said even about Mitt Romney of late, not being of a truly American mainline religious group, they could be cast as essentially enemies of the state, and then all of this stuff would kick in.
Well, what remember scares what me Jesus? Most about this, Lincoln, what scares me is that you haven't had to have done anything. You have only had to maybe made a comment someplace. You may have written a letter. You may have written an article. You are looked upon as a terrorist, not because of something you've done, but because of something you've thought about. Am I on the right track here?
Absolutely. And a number of legal experts quite shortly after 9/11 have said we're perilously close to creating thought crime.
Well, thought crime, exactly. What you're about to do, what you're thinking about doing. We're going to arrest you. We're going to put you in jail forever because what you're thinking about doing.
No, I don't think we're even close to the military, going out on some hate agenda, rounding up people generally. But as I said it to someone who mocked at me on this, I said, just imagine if in your neighborhood there's some terrorist action at a mall, say there's an explosion and some violent act and suddenly a military detachment sweeps through your neighborhood in hot pursuit. They think of some lead. And they come down there and they'll knock on the doors, I'm sure, asking if people know about someone, what they've seen. Plus, they will have a list, which the governments have, of who's gone on certain websites and giving to charitable groups with a shadow over them. So if they come to your neighbor and you are on the list for having given money to an iffy cause, you belong to a religious group out of the mainstream, and your neighbor says, oh, yes, they're trouble, those people, they're not good Americans or whatever. You're likely to be pulled in by the military just because, you know, they don't like ambiguity. They would pull you in because it takes you out of the potential for doing something right then and there. But they won't have a charge. They won't have information. You'll be put in a stockade. And the military, in my view, whether it's the U.S. or the British or the Australian or anyone, they don't hand you over to civil courts. No. It's not in their interest. They don't believe the civil court has enough to deal with you adequately. They don't trust them. They will keep you off the battlefield. And so I think that's the spectre that we're likely to see gratuitous detentions. If there are ongoing acts, as there really have been since 9/11, there's been a number of cases, this fellow Hassan at a military base and others on college campuses driving their cars through crowds of people to kill them. There's really been a number of jihadi-inspired actions. So when any of these will actually precipitate a military response, I don't know, but it's certain that it will at some point. And people that are concerned about civil liberties should be watching this. And people that realize that the war on terror has a religious component, there's a religious subtext to it, and that in an America more and more sort of appealing to God and country as one and the same, it could be very easy to be on the wrong side of that equation. And literally, as Jesus said, someone will think, a true patriot, that they were doing the will of God to maybe detain you or even to give the go signal to liquidate someone from the air. I mean, it sounds bizarre even as I say it, but this is not totally hypothetical. It's an extrapolation from what's already happening, and here's an enabling law. It could happen, and there are those that think it could happen and are not troubled.
Well, it sounds bizarre to us, but you ask a survivor of the Nazi concentration camps, and they're going to say, well, that sounds very familiar to me.
Well, we shouldn't go as far afield. Any Nazi analogy troubles most people. But, we certainly can go back to World War II and the detention, mass detention of Japanese citizens.
Yes.
And there was one single incident of those hundreds of thousands. I think it was actually in total maybe some millions, but hundreds of thousands that were detained. Not one of them or their families or anyone living in the U.S. was ever implicated in the slightest disloyal act. So it was pure paranoia, but provisions were put in that were absolutely unconstitutional. They were deprived of their liberty and their property. Most people have forgotten that.
Yes.
Not their life, but now with predator drones and that, the questions are not asked. There's a decision made up front that this person is a threat just by their very ideology, and which might be so with an al-Qaeda, but it's a judgment call that someone else might be swept up into that sort of a thinking, and they may just be a victim of a sincere but misdirected decision by someone who should not have that authority, whether it's a military commander, whether it's some mid-level government official, or even whether it comes out of deliberations in the Oval Office. I mean, it's not disloyal to our president or whoever that individual may be to realize that they were never intended to have such extreme power over people without due process.
The West African nation of Sierra Leone has been ravaged by more than 10 years of civil war, creating severe food shortages. AGRA workers, busy training students in rural schools to establish school gardens, are now being approached by parents and guardians to help them create kitchen gardens. Your gift will help one rural family start such a garden, providing them with food and a means of income. Your gift grows in Sierra Leone. This is just one of many opportunities offered to you in this year's edition of the Adventist Development and Relief Agency International's The Original Really Useful Gift Catalog. To find out more, visit www.adra.org. That's www.adra.org. Or call 1-800-424-ADRA. That's 1-800-424-2372. This is your chance to select the perfect gift for that special someone who has nothing. Thank you.
I've often, in talks about civil liberties and religious freedom, reminded people that even in the Civil War, which was a huge test of the constitutional principles, there was a little moment when President Lincoln was frustrated by his inability, he thought, to deal with enemies, and he suspended the writ of habeas corpus, mm-hmm. the right of trial and charge and due process. And the Chief Justice took to the streets and said that we have a you know, a government out of control here. And for a little moment that I'm so glad, and looking back on it, that it passed, President Lincoln was angry enough to start drawing up an arrest document for the Supreme Court Chief Justice. Oh. You know, that's the way of craziness, not to use more troubling words. And we're not quite there yet, but we're incrementally creeping towards something that I believe while it might in a very small way have helped tamp down the terrorist tendencies of a world that's under great stress, it will also probably more rapidly destroy the general freedoms we have. And since the war on terror, to reiterate my point, has a religious component, where religious extremists, out of the fanatics, out of the mainstream, right. You know, fanaticism is a loaded word,
yes.
Could be swept in and easily seen as enemies. And it hasn't escaped my attention and others that periodically the U.S., since 9/11, is inclined to add to its list of terrorist groups. In previous days, during the Cold War, we embraced most of those because we liked the fact that they were opposed either militarily or ideologically to nefarious regimes. Mm-hmm. Now, with that threat gone, and we know that in the modern world with communication, there is generally ideological linkage or at least communication between these groups. So, you know, they've come to the determination. Any little group that pops up that's got some radical agenda, You declare them terrorists when all of these extreme laws kick in, when the extreme laws about giving donations to terrorist groups kick in, and someone very innocently could give a donation to a group that may now be designated as a danger to the state. That's but right. They thought that they were just helping a freedom movement in another part of the country. This was the case in Northern Ireland. Where at the highest levels of government here at the time, you know, they were applauding American citizens who were funding this. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the British government would think very, very differently of that.
Yes.
And it's not insignificant that after 9/11, this whole issue in Northern Ireland was resolved because the IRA saw quickly that they were on the wrong side of history here, that they were going to be equated with Islamic terrorists, and they knew how they were being dealt with. So, you know, they made their peace. But my point is that the different citizens with overseas sympathies and so on already are at great risk, with often religious charities, of being swept up inadvertently and being seen as enemies of the state. And that's the scenario that I think becomes dangerous with this new military funding bill and its provision there that the military can detain without trial, you know, just on a presumption that could be on the thinnest of yes. circumstantial evidence. And it's of a religious nature. That's what I'm getting at. I mean, there's civil liberties issues all across the waterfront here, but yeah. Religion is not an inconsequential player.
Now, Lincoln, you've identified a very real problem, or at least the potential of a very real problem. Is there any way in your mind that we as individuals, we as religious groups, can start now in an effort to protect ourselves from what may come?
Well, I think a public outcry is really all that's needed. But this program is not designed to incite people to political activity per se. But I wish more people were aware of it. This is only gaining traction because the average person is desensitized on the importance of a whole waterfront of issues that are religious and of civil governance.
And this stuff is buried in a 600-plus page document that no one reads anyway.
Well, yes, and that's often the case. And the average citizen can't be expected to read it all through. But if they were engaged when they heard some well-placed senators and congressmen objecting to it, you know, they can make their will known. I really think there's a stupefying element that's come across society. While we're not in a good time, the economy's bad, generally speaking, people don't feel particularly threatened or motivated to participate in these real discussions. Then they're just letting it slide on by. Mm-hmm. And I will invoke Germany in that regard. Germany became under Hitler was in a time of great social distress and economic collapse and so on. But a lot of people just let go of their responsibilities and allowed the political system to flow on. They saw Hitler rise and he made certain moral statements. But it's not like people were unaware that this guy was a bit dangerous. They just didn't think it would amount to anything, and they were not jealous for their liberties. And but by the time he got in and on a subterfuge declared a state of emergency, and the there was in essence worship of him as the supreme Führer, it was too late. And we're almost at that point now. To object to these things, you run the risk of being accused of a terrorist sympathizer, as the radio stations, the conservative ones, all the time accuse their political opponents of being traitors. So, you know, back to Jesus. I want to put it on a biblical basis. Our absolute loyalty needs to be to God and to spiritual principles and live moral lives before the court of the universe, not thinking, you know, is this going to break or satisfy some quibbling civil law? If we obey the higher law, we should be good citizens. But we need to recognize the times that we live in. These are dangerous times, very dangerous times, and that the spiritual conflict between the spirit and the civil powers that Jesus spoke about is not just in some crazy banana republic or desert oasis. It could be here. And we need to live more circumspect spiritual lives, and we need to be more engaged in a society that makes claims of liberty and freedom to make sure that those things are protected, not just presume that because they're under glass in some nice building downtown that you're safe. It's not the case.
You know, and also one of the ways that we can protect ourselves and our neighbors and our country is to be involved in the Liberty Movement. And Liberty Magazine, of course, is at the forefront of that movement. And I invite you, listener, to visit the website libertymagazine.org to find out how you can be involved in the magazine and get the magazine to the people. Because apparently, what I hear you saying, Lincoln Steed, in the past is that the movers and shakers, many of them are reading this magazine and are taking it to heart. Am I right?
I hope so, because we've got an article coming out on this, although the horses have bolted on this one. The president or the White House said that they would veto this, and he has not.
Yeah.
He chose not to. I don't know. It could be everybody's fiddling while Rome burns.
Oh,
but we do know that many of the legislators get and read Liberty Magazine, and we hope that this, as well as other input, will help sharpen their thinking on something that is not just of civil import. It has religious liberty implications.
Boy, I guess so. Lincoln Steed, editor of Liberty Magazine, thank you so much for being with us today.
Always a pleasure.
Opening our minds to these things. Wow. And listener, until next time, this is Charles Mills along with Lincoln Steed inviting you to rest in the freedom of God's love. Goodbye, everyone. You've been listening to Life Quest Liberty. To further explore the issues discussed on today's program, visit www.libertymagazine.org. Join us again next week at this same time as we examine more of the threats and challenges facing your religious freedom. May God keep the flames of religious freedom burning in your heart today.